Hey, Chris Manning from Locked On Cavs here. Coming up on today's show, Evan and I are going to talk about some of the teams we would like to see the Cavs emulate from, learn from, kind of model themselves after as they kind of move into trying to build something on their own in a post-LeBron world. Additionally, John Corral is up first with me on the show talking about the Celtics or the Cavs plan Wednesday, 7 p.m. tip in Cleveland. Boston is playing a game against the Nets on Tuesday night, so there will be potentially some stuff that changes, but the overall conversation I had with John will get you ready and all things updated with that Boston Celtics team. That's coming up today on Locked On Cavs, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Cleveland Cavaliers select Darius Garland from Vanderbilt University.
My. It's called the Kevin Love Show.
Kyrie Irving, he's gone. Xbox at him today at the Q.
On the blow block. He put him in cement boots. Colin Sexton for two.
Joining me now, John Corrales, the host of Locked On Celtics, one of the hosts of the Locked On NBA show during the week. John, how's it going?
Great. How you doing?
I'm doing good. So you obviously are covering a very interesting Celtics team this year. What to you is the defining story as we're, you know, getting closer to the end here, but what to you is the defining characteristic, the dominant storylines or whatever you may be about this particular team?
Well, I think right now the dominant storyline has been the ascension of Jason Tatum. I mean, his big leap forward has been just wild to see. And it goes along with maybe the bigger storyline with the Celtics that this season has almost been a best-case scenario for the Celtics with very few kind of things that have gone wrong. Obviously, the injuries have gone wrong, but they've navigated those roads pretty well. And along with that, maybe they didn't get a full opportunity to see what rookies could impact the bench because Romeo Langford had more injuries than most in the beginning of the season. He never had a chance to kind of catch on. But in general, the overarching theme of this season is like, wow, everything has gone extraordinarily well. Kemba Walker has fit in pretty seamlessly. Jason Tatum has taken a huge leap forward. Jalen Brown has taken a big leap forward as well. Gordon Hayward has come in and generally been pretty good and has gotten back to, like, no one's asking about his health anymore. The center position that was supposed to be this big weakness, Daniel Tice has been really good in that role, and he fits pretty well. The bench was never expected to be much, so if there's any downside to it, the bench hasn't been particularly great. Once this team is fully healthy, if they ever are, they have the ability to, you know, stagger and have Marcus Smart coming off of the bench and kind of solve that problem a little bit that way. But that's generally the theme for the Celtics this season.
When you consider Tatum, he's obviously, you know, was, I think, somewhat disappointing last year for some people. But what for you, when you think about how good he's been, how big of a leap has it been, and where do you kind of think he's at in terms of the hierarchy in the league right now? People have obviously seen what he did in Utah and did against the Lakers, but how big of a leap has this been this whole season?
Well, it's been pretty huge because, I mean, especially when you consider last season, how, I don't want to say poorly, because he still had a good season. It's just the expectations were pretty high. I think that maybe people would have expected this to go last year and then for this to be like the huge year, but you know, circumstances were where they were, and I'm not going to rehash that. But this year, he spent, I think, the first 3 months of the season kind of almost experimenting with his game. He started out really attacking the rim, and he had a month where he just couldn't hit a layup. But he was just kind of like jumping off of one foot and praying, and that obviously wasn't going to work for him. And then he started launching a lot of floaters. And then he started taking a ton of step backs. And now what you're seeing, I think, is him saying, okay, this worked in the first month, this worked in the second month, this is working in the third month, now I'm going to put it all together. And, like, the instant that he became an all-star, like, that day, he just took off. He put it all together, and now he's playing a much more complete game. And maybe the best thing I can say, the best compliment I can give him, is that he has taken a leap into potential, like, third-team All-NBA. I mean, I'm not saying definite, but he's in the conversation, and he still has a lot of improvement that he can undergo. Like, he can still vastly improve his ball handling. He can still improve his decision-making off of double teams. He can still improve his passing. There's a lot of things that are very well within his grasp. You know, a couple of summers of work, just more game reps, more defenses that are keying in on him as a star player. All of those things are learning experience for a kid who just turned 22 on March 3rd. That all of those things can combine to really take him to another level. Where is he now in the hierarchy of the NBA? It's hard to say. I mean, he's certainly not quite superstar level. I would say he's probably at whatever you want to consider a star. I don't know, top 25, top 30, top 40. I mean, it's all subjective from there, but he's in the upper echelon of the league, and I would say that he's got a shot, depending on how the rest of the season goes. He's got a shot at making one of the All-NBA teams.
Right now, obviously, just so people know, we're recording this before Boston plays the Nets on Tuesday night. Obviously, they're going to play in Cleveland on the second half of a back-to-back. But what is as we record this, John, what is the latest on Kemba Walker, and what will getting him back kind of healthy mean for this team?
Well, Kemba is going to play against the Nets, but he's not going to be playing in back-to-backs. So I wouldn't expect him to play in Cleveland. I wouldn't expect him to travel to Cleveland, as a matter of fact. I would say that he's probably going to stay home, undergo treatment, not bother getting up into a plane, a pressurized cabin, and dealing with whatever swelling. Like, you just want to minimize that as much as you can. So he'll get eased in with a minutes restriction against Brooklyn. He'll skip, I assume, the Cleveland game, and then they'll kind of see how he responds to the treatment and the return to play and determine how many minutes he could play against Utah. But I wouldn't expect him to play in the back-to-back next week, the Milwaukee-Washington back-to-back. He might not play in the Toronto-Brooklyn back-to-back the week after. The Celtics have three back-to-backs in the month of March. So I wouldn't expect him to play in any of them, but slowly they're going to ramp him up. He looks okay. Like, he's out there running. He's been out there shooting. It's not like he had to stay off of the knee. It's been more of a strengthening program. So I don't think it's something that's been debilitating and that has cost him a lot of conditioning. It's just been he's played for Team USA. He's played a long season. They expect him to have a long postseason. This is the most basketball that he's played as a pro in his life. And so being smaller, being an undersized guard, having to go into the trees, falling a lot, all of that adds up. Being 30, all of it adds up. And so they want to make sure that he's prepared not only for this long haul, for this season and a long playoff run that they hope they have, but to come back for next season and try to manage it so it's not something that costs him a ton of games moving forward.
John, last thing, when you look at this team, whether it's the, you know, of late or just kind of the whole year, what is just one thing you think they do well that people don't really pick up on enough, and what is one thing you think they struggle with that maybe people should note heading into Wednesday?
Well, I think the one thing that they do well is they are, I think, a better isolation team than people might think. In fact, I will say that that might be a strength and a weakness, that they don't pass the ball as much as you think. And they're good at it. They kind of take turns scoring, and that's something that can help them. But also, that's also something that, if you look at the Houston game, that can be exploited. So I will answer in saying that one of their biggest strengths can be their biggest weaknesses. And really, there's an unanswered portion to that question moving forward because of Tatum's kind of leap here since January, where he's become kind of like, oh, yeah, he's the number one guy. He's now Boston's best player. But they paid Kemba Walker $100 million to be their best player. And Kemba's been very unselfish and very willing to take a step back. But the entire season has operated under certain terms. And while Kemba's been nursing his knee back to health, Jason Tatum's kind of like altered the terms. It's like Darth Vader to Lando Calrissian. I've altered the terms of the deal. Pray I don't alter them any further. I don't know how this is going to work out between these two moving forward. I expect it to be fine because they like each other. They have a great relationship on and off the floor. But whenever you change a team dynamic mid-season, there is a possibility of like, oh, well, this is how I always played, but now we're playing a little bit differently because of Tatum, and it's at least a curiosity, not necessarily a concern, but a curiosity.
You can find John on the Locked On Celtics podcast. Check him out on Locked On NBA as well. He just did a show on Tuesday with Jake Madison that will give you a ton of great league coverage in there, so check that out. And John, thanks so much for coming on.
You got it, my man.
All right, I'm back here with Evan Damrell, my co-host. Evan, what's going on, buddy?
Not a whole lot. It's kind of a weird day weather-wise. It's a Tuesday. It's Super Tuesday for those who vote. But I'm ready to talk about teams that I'd like the Cavs to kind of take a page out of their book and model themselves after in this Renaissance era.
Yeah, so what we are going to do today is, as I mentioned at the top of the show, talk about guys that or teams that we think the Cavs can learn from. So there are certainly going to be teams, you know, across the league that are run well, teams that are not as well. So the Cavs, I think historically have had some stuff where they're not quite as, let's say, well run as some other teams, which is not exactly what you're looking for a team that certainly I think has had its most success with LeBron James. So what Evan and I are going to do, we're going to talk about four teams today. The obvious ones that we're not going to talk about would be the Miami Heat, who obviously have a kind of fabled culture, and the San Antonio Spurs, who obviously are just sort of one of the gold standards of all NBA franchises. So what we're going to do is each pick another two teams apiece, four teams in total, that we think the Cavs could learn from. If you have your own that you'd like to hear us talk about in the future, or if you just want to share your own, you can email us at lockdowncavs@gmail.com, and I'll shout them out on the next show, or tweet us at lockdowncavs. But Evan, give me your first team here.
I think overall, like in terms of just impressiveness of where they've been, where they've gone, and where they're headed, are the Toronto Raptors. Like it starts at the top, and Masai Ujiri is one of the best, if not the best, general manager in the league, and he has done a remarkable job just acquiring talent and assets and just kind of taking gambles and risks. Like that Kawhi Leonard trade will go down as one of the ballsiest and probably smartest moves of the last decade in NBA history, because look, it gave them a championship and it cost them arguably the face of the franchise at the time in DeMar DeRozan. But I think you make that trade every single time if you're guaranteed that type of result. And I guess just for the Cavs' sake of things, like let's not get too far ahead, but Toronto's build up to this point was after Chris Bosh left town to join LeBron, and when he took his talents to South Beach, Ujiri wasn't in charge at the time, if I remember correctly. He was still in Denver, wasn't he?
Yes, he was with the Denver Nuggets, and then he's obviously been for a long time kind of recruited or fantasized about the Knicks.
Yeah, so I don't think he's going to leave anytime soon, but he's the Raptors under, and just after the post Chris Bosh just slowly acquired assets and built a competent, at least playoff team, which is always a good baseline to have. And they slowly just built that up, and they built a title team that it worked out last year. And then look, this season, Toronto is still a pretty damn good team. And that a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're well coached with Nick Nurse. Like they have a good coach, which I think is something you definitely need to lean on, who's somebody who's young and innovative and able to get the most out of their roster. But the most important thing to me with Toronto is they're able to find talent with later picks or even undrafted players and properly develop them within their system and then make them key role players that they can, that allows them to have the sustainable success. I mean, granted, Pascal Siakam went from a role player to a bona fide star, and then you have like nice complementary veterans like Kyle Lowry and Marc Gasol, but then you have awesome complementary pieces like Fred VanVleet, and then, I mean, Terrence Ferguson is coming up. Not Terrence Ferguson.
Terrence Davis.
Yeah, that's it. Sorry. Trevor Magnotti's draft darling. Like, he's going to be a nice piece for them long term, and like, Toronto's just done a really good job building themselves into a consistent team. And then future-wise as well, I know Milwaukee fans, if you're listening, you don't want to hear this, but there is a legitimate concern with the Bucks that I've just kind of seen by reading the tea leaves that Giannis could bolt to Toronto in free agency if he decides that Milwaukee ain't going to be part of his long-term plans. And then Masai Ujiri has shown the wherewithal that he can cash in on a situation to make a title team again. And if you have a foundation of Pascal Siakam and Giannis Antetokounmpo, like, good freaking luck, buddy. So I think that's like kind of the others than San Antonio and Miami. San Antonio, like you said, is the gold standard. Like, Toronto would be a team that Cleveland would definitely want to take a page out of and emulate if they want to do like a slow burn rebuild, and they'd at least build a competent playoff team. And then if the time ever or situation ever arises to cash in and become an immediate title threat, like, by all means, I'm all for doing that.
Yeah, I think Toronto's is a great one. They were on my initial list as well. Just running through the list, here are guys that they've developed and turned into useful rotation players that none of them were really high draft picks. Norman Powell, Fred VanVleet, Siakam obviously is kind of the big one there, who's now a max player. OG Anunoby, who I quite like and is obviously kind of blossoming this year. If you want to go down the list, obviously, you know, they got Terrence Davis, who's maybe like been the somewhere between the third and like sixth best rookie this year, you could argue. And then you even just want to get guys that they developed well in the G League, like Chris Boucher, who's not like a great player, but is like a useful, can fill minutes NBA player. One of my big critiques I think that I've had with the Cavs, even within LeBron era, is that they're starting to change this with, I think, Dean Wade more than anybody else. But yeah. I don't think the Cavs have always treated the Canton Charge exactly like the feeder league for your club that I think it should be. I think the one of the hacks we're going to see, this is just like a not source, this is just like a guess prediction. I think in the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to have a team that's like really churning out guys coming out of the G League. And even if they're not probably not going to be stars, but they're going to develop cost effective, good rotation pieces via the G League, get them in the organization, really develop them and turn them into stuff. Toronto could be the team that does that. And again, just look at their roster. Look at the guys that they've developed and helped manifest into really, really good players, coupled with the ability to spend, coupled with a really strong executive who has done all the right stuff pretty much all along the way. I don't think every organization would have like necessarily fired made the change to in coaches and going with Nick Nurse instead of Dwayne Casey, just because Casey had been solid, and you know, he went with Nurse, trusted in that, and they had that vision. I think they're like they're maybe the best organization in the league right now. Think that there's very few blemishes on their record, if any.
No, I agree with that, and you know, maybe they took a page out of David Griffin's book by figuring out that here's the thing. Dwayne Casey was coach of the year and got fired. But the Cavs completely victimized Toronto every single year in the playoffs. And, you know, I get it. Like, you go all in, and like, there's a lot of skepticism at the time with hiring Nick Nurse as the team's ex head coach. He was the architect of Toronto becoming one of the more efficient offenses in the leagues. And people just kind of pointed to the fact that, well, Cleveland just shut down that offense with their defense, and Cleveland actually wasn't. I mean, in the playoffs, they were a defensive juggernaut because Mike Longobardi got kicked to the curb and Ty Lue took the reins of the situation. But during like the regular season, they obviously weren't. But no, like you said, there's very few blemishes on the way Toronto was operating, and it's definitely refreshing. It's Spursian-esque, I would say, in the fact that they kind of just develop their own talent internally and they make smart tactical decisions that benefit them long term. Like trading or acquiring Serge Ibaka was a great move. Acquiring Marc Gasol was a great move. Kyle Lowry, acquiring him all those years ago, was a great move. And then, I mean, people have been imploring Toronto after Kawhi Leonard left town to just blow this thing up and start with a long term rebuild. And, you know, Toronto just kind of thumbed their nose at that suggestion and they kept on keeping on. And they're the second best team in the Eastern Conference and the top five team in the NBA now, which is kind of wild to say when you really look at it, because they don't have like a legitimate superstar on their roster. They're just balanced at every single position.
Yeah, I'm bored with it. Okay, so my first one is the LA Clippers. So obviously they're connected mm-hmm. there because of Kawhi, and like certainly I think the jury is still out on what they're doing. They obviously have the advantage of Los Angeles. We will talk about a certain team that is really good at LA court. I'm going to bring up in the next segment with another team that is from a piece written about said team earlier this year. But I think that the Clippers, when you look at Ballmer's willingness to spend, that's pretty analogous to Dan Gilbert. You look at the way they're investing in just everything about the organization, doing unique stuff. Like they hired Lee Jenkins to kind of help them help them better get to know guys and kind of relate to them more. There's no limit on cost. They've kept a good coach there. They've been pretty savvy in the roster stuff. They drafted well with Shea. They were able to obviously go get big guys and were not afraid to make the big move that felt they could help them compete. Again, like that. And it's just an organization that like had a vision, knew what it wanted to do and executed it. And there's just like something to that. Again, they have the LA advantage, you know, Kawhi, obviously kind of wanting to go there and wanting to play in LA certainly gives you an advantage that the Cavs are probably never going to have.
Mm-mm.
But when you look at just that organization the last couple of years, the way they've kind of, they were able to pivot away from the Donald Sterling stuff to, from the Chris Paul Lob City era to just everything that has come to what they are now and being, you know, one of the teams that certainly could win a title this year. And so much of that coming from Ballmer and Ballmer's willingness to spend and invest mm-hmm. in the club and kind of make the most of it because he's very rich. I think, like, I'm not saying Dan should like go broke running the Cavs, but like, and to his credit, I think that one of the best things he's ever done has been spend when it's judicious to spend. I think the Cavs, as they're looking towards getting, if they can get to a point in the future where it's worth it, I think you can certainly learn from the Clippers. And I just look at everything they're trying to do to carve out their own identity. I think there's a lot to be learned from it.
No, I agree. And I think having Ballmer as the owner, especially because Donald Sterling was a horrible human being and just was awful at mismanaging the Clippers. Like it's certainly weird to say that the Clippers aren't just an absolute tire fire and a joke of an organization anymore, but no, Ballmer is one, obviously a very wealthy human being, but he's also passionate and he likes to win. I mean, I'm sure people have seen him doing his his speech when he was with Microsoft, the developers, and have seen like just clips of him going acting like the biggest fan possible, watching the Clippers just do something exciting. But no, LA's just kind of been, like you said, they transitioned really well from the Lob City Clippers era, where eventually they kind of realized they plateaued and they weren't going to get that far with Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, and Chris Paul running the show, and they've pivoted really well and just acquired a lot of young and exciting pieces at first and just built a solid foundation, much like Toronto did. You can kind of draw a little bit of a parallel in that regard, but granted, like you said, Los Angeles is a destination market and Kawhi Leonard has expressed every desire to go back to Los Angeles. And I think getting Paul George and recruiting him in the shadows was definitely a coup on Kawhi's part and the Clippers' part. But no, I really, like you said, like having an owner that's willing to spend and an owner that's willing to go all in when the opportunity arises, but you also have a stable and competent organization surrounding it. Like that's super appealing when you're in a glamour market like Los Angeles, where you can appeal to free agents and make it kind of just a premier destination, especially considering that you play in the same building as one of the biggest legacy franchises in the NBA.
If not the.
Yeah. So like Steve Ballmer's white whale is trying to get out from underneath the Lakers' shadow. And I feel like they're going to be playing in the Forum in Inglewood eventually. And then I've seen the renderings of what the Clippers do propose the arena looks like. Like it's going to be absolutely insane. They have like a botanical garden on the exterior of the arena itself, which is nuts. And it's just kind of, you know, on brand for Steve Ballmer. But no, like it's just having an owner that's that invested in your team and the fact that he's an outsider to Los Angeles. Like there's always that fear that saying like, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but let's say Dan Gilbert's situation after post stroke, like he doesn't make a full recovery and his family doesn't want to manage the team. And the Cavs end up selling, like an outsider comes in and buys the team. Like there's always the fear that they're going to move it. No, Steve Ballmer fully went all in on keeping the Clippers in LA and just becoming the team in Los Angeles. And it's really good for the state of basketball, obviously, that both teams in Los Angeles are super good now, but I think it makes it even more fun that the owner of the Clippers is making it a personal agenda to try and beat out the Lakers when the Lakers already have so much going for them.
Yeah, I think that's all right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, come back next week with more Locked On Cavs. Stay tuned. All right, we're back here on Locked On Cavs. Chris Manning, Evan Demmer, last segment for this Wednesday, March 4th show. Evan, I'll go first on this one. Mine is the Indiana Pacers. Mm-hmm. So I thought about the Denver Nuggets. I thought about just talking about the Heat anyway, but I will also admit that I'm very much swayed by this Rob Mahoney piece from The Ringer from a few months back about how this franchise has really made itself kind of competent and competitive and able to maintain a certain level of quality over three decades. One of the notes from the story that I think I'll link this in the show notes to make sure people have read it. I think I've even mentioned it before. I have. The only franchise in the last three decades that has made the playoffs more times than the Indiana Pacers is the San Antonio Spurs. Since 2010, they have only missed the playoffs one time. That is after a tiebreaker for the eighth seed in a season where Paul George missed basically the whole year because of that horrific leg injury shuffle. This is a team that was able to retool on the fly. Certainly got really lucky with Oladipo and Sabonis developing where they did, but nonetheless, like, I think had a vision for those guys. They're well coached. Their organization is prudent. They are obviously willing to go and try and make upgrades when they need to. You know, there's just like a whole bunch of ways that they have been able to just kind of take things that aren't, you know, the top flight stuff. Like, they haven't had a number one pick. They haven't had anything that is like particularly extremely notable in terms of their roster and how they've built it. And yet they are where they are now. A solid team, you know, maybe never going to cap out, but willing to go spend to go get Malcolm Brogdon and improve and stuff like that. I just think it's a really well-run organization. I think they're well-coached. I think, you know, there's certainly some stuff that they've missed on. But I think if you're just looking at maintaining in a market size similar to Cleveland and all this stuff, they've done really well in that sense. I think the Cavs could learn from just kind of observing it, figuring out what worked for Indiana, what hasn't worked, and just kind of observing it from afar and just trying to steal some of that DNA and applying it to them.
I think Indiana is definitely a good team for Cleveland to take a page out of their book with, especially like you said, they never really had a number one pick during this quote unquote just floating era between Paul George and where they're at now. I mean, that's what I'm kind of basing this off of, because those Paul George, like that Paul George, that team that had featured Paul George, Lance Stephenson, and Roy Hibbert was a pretty nasty team, but they couldn't get over the hump necessarily, and just like, injuries and everything else kind of derailed everything, and eventually like they transitioned to where they are now. But like you said, like they never really had a top pick, and so far, and 2 years after life after LeBron, the top pick that they had is fifth overall, Darius Garland. And the way the lottery odds are going for the Cavs, like there's a good chance that Cleveland could never really get a number one pick, and with their luck, it's probably going to be in, like the worst draft imaginable. So it's just like the equivalent of giving like the third through sixth pick in any other draft. No, like Indiana's just been super smart, super prudent with just acquiring talent and just kind of finding players that one fit their culture and fit like what they're trying to strive and what they're building for. And like you said, like they'll make smart free agent moves that fit into their timeline. Like Malcolm Brogdon pairs, like I thought it was a great move at the time, even when Oladipo was hurt, like they have a playmaker to play. And then who can complement Oladipo well, because Malcolm Brogdon, let's remember here, was the fourth option offensively on a Milwaukee team that featured Giannis Antetokounmpo, or fourth to third option, depending on the night, that featured Giannis Antetokounmpo, Chris Middleton, Eric Bledsoe, and then there's Malcolm Brogdon kind of just playing cleanup duty at the two or the one, depending on the matchup. Like Brogdon's definitely comfortable taking the third or second or third fiddle behind Victor, or even fourth fiddle behind Vic Oladipo, down to Sabonis and Miles Turner. Like that's just really smart free agency moves. And it's not like a desperation move either, which is even crazier to say. And I like your point about the coach as well, where I remember when Indiana was in town on Saturday, JB Bickerstaff kind of expanded on the fact that he's really impressed like with the job Nick McMillan does. And like he has coached this team into his vision and his identity where they don't really beat themselves. And I could kind of feel like JB's admiration was genuine when it came to the way Nate McMillan is running the show in Indiana, and 100%. I think maybe that's something that Cleveland could strive for sure, where they just kind of build a team where they can't beat themselves. And maybe I'm not saying that J.B. Bickerstaff is going to have a Nate McMillan type of success in like McMillan has in Indiana, but I remember when McMillan was hired by Indiana to be the team's next head coach, like people panned the move, and I'm trying to maybe just grasp at straws a little bit here, but people did pan J.B. Bickerstaff becoming, at least outside and then within Cleveland sports as well, outside like viewing in and within Cleveland sports as well, like they panned the hire. But maybe that's just kind of the situation where you have a competent enough coach where you just kind of build this or shape this roster and guide it into a way where it necessarily won't beat itself. Yeah, no, Cleveland, if they wanted to go in the Indiana route and just maybe not go for the full-blown rebuild because they are in a smaller market as well and just trying to maintain relevancy and be able to maintain a bit of a revenue stream and everything else, no, by all means, I think that's a smart move as well, and I think definitely Indiana is a team that Cleveland could take a page out of.
One last thing I'll read about this that I'll just a little excerpt from Rob's piece here. Quote, a team working in Indiana's constrained teams every edge it can find. This is a franchise that generally ranks in the bottom third of the league in terms of payroll, doesn't have the benefit of spending into luxury tax, and has to convince young millionaires to come to one of the NBA's smallest, coldest markets. Quote, you can't compete with LA, McMillan says, even though you compete with LA. The strongest appeal is to give players a chance to win, to be part of a team that plays hard and hit the ceiling. That, to me, is what the Cavs should be striving to, distilled into a paragraph. Rob Mahoney, the most underrated NBA writer that exists, don't freaking at me. Don't forking at me. My guy is...
You should give yourself a little credit here, Chris. No, I think you're pretty underrated.
I agree. I'm feeling cocky today. You're underrated as well. But Rob is like just been cranking out excellent stuff at SI and The Ringer. And it's just like there are people that just make like bad jokes on Twitter and like get more acclaim than Rob. Rob's great. Read Rob Mahoney. He's always really, really, really good. Excellent shoe game from the one time I ran into him in the finals as well. Rob, great. Loved to would have not been awkward and got a chance to talk to him at that finals.
I'm on the show, Rob.
Yeah, Rob, come on the show. Come on, Locked On Cavs. Haley O'Shaughnessy, hook it up. Okay, what is your next one, Evan? What is your last pick here?
People are going to tease me because people call me like a closet Celtics fan because let's just do a little quick time warp. I was on the Chase Down podcast a while ago where they were drafting, where Carter came up with a fun game where we spent like a solid hour drafting teams for this season based on how far we think they would go, and I made a pretty safe bet on the Boston Celtics saying that I felt comfortable in selecting them, and like that's just kind of been the joke for a while. And I've been quietly just kind of praising Jason Tatum on here. Not quietly on here, I'm pretty loud on here. So praising Jason Tatum and where they're going, but just like I like the way that Danny Ainge Fleet or bent Kobe Altman over a barrel with this Isaiah Thomas trade. If you're looking back at it, I mean, yes, Colin Sexton is a good player. We don't hate Colin Sexton. I just want to make that super clear for
everybody. I wrote a really positive piece about Colin Sexton. Just want to let people know.
Yeah, everyone read it because Chris and I have the same sentiments. Like he sent me it before he published it. I'm like, oh, this is great. And then I like walked away thinking like, yeah, no, I agree with every single point Chris made. So we don't hate Colin Sexton. But anyways, getting back on track. Danny Ainge saw the writing on the wall at the fact that the Celtics had peaked under Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, who had left town at that point for Miami, and Rajon Rondo, and just blew it up and traded to the Nets. And I remember at the time, like Bill Simmons was absolutely disgusted, thinking like the Nets fleeced the Celtics, and Danny Ainge had no idea what he was doing. I think he even said like they'd be middling first round picks, and no, they. The Celtics made a lot of smart moves where they acquired Jaylen Brown by doing that. They acquired Jason Tatum by doing that. And then I want to say Terry Rozier was included in that, and they flipped Terry Rozier for Kemba Walker. And it's a lot more of a slow burn to the rebuild, and maybe blowing it up isn't the best strategy for the Cavs because, again, Boston is a legacy market, and the fact that Celtics fans will always turn out even when the product is absolutely garbage, you can't say the same for the Cavs. But I think that strategy is definitely admirable where you acquire as many assets as possible. And yeah, it's easy to poke fun at Danny Ainge for sitting on them more often than not, but like he made moves, at least at the time, like that Kyrie trade at the time, it blew up in spectacular fashion. But at the time I'm like, okay, well no, Boston just moved the needle and made themselves a legitimate title threat. But no, they also have long-term sustainable success as well because they have a very promising young core and just centered around Tatum and Brown. And I think going wing heavy is always a smart move, especially in today's modern NBA. And you just kind of gamble on it and see what you get. And I can't wait to see my mentions tomorrow, because I'm sure people are going to be like, well, Evan's a closet Celtics fan. Now we all know. But yeah, no, I think if the Cavs kind of just took a page out of Boston's book with like asset accumulation and just being patient with the process itself and not rushing things and find the right head coach like Brad Stevens to start this whole process within itself, like, that's a great thing to do. And Cleveland's just kind of beginning this rebuild process where they're in the talent acquisition phase. So hopefully they maybe start doing that, but I don't know. We'll see what happens, especially if the Cavs start flipping veterans, then maybe they really start taking a page out of Boston's book this summer.
Yeah. One of the other things too, is when you look at like trades that they've made, and they haven't made obvious every trade, and there's certainly like critiques that maybe like Danny and their front office was not being aggressive enough. But if you want to look at like a trade they made that is just ultimately going to go down as like an insanely consequential trade, is them with Philly, where they end up with Tatum and they get a pick, and Philly gets Fultz. And obviously we know what happened with Fultz. Jason Tatum, we talked here with John Corrales, and you've just watched him lately. The guy is absolutely just breaking out, becoming an absolute star.
Terrible tattoo game.
They identified that guy and were like, okay, like that's our guy. We're going to bank on him. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. You know, and like they were able to, like, you know, there is a little bit of coldness, like with just like the Isaiah Thomas thing is certainly not going to, you know, I don't blame anyone who would like feel a little bit like Danny did Isaiah a little dirty. Certainly the Kyrie thing is weird. You know, I'm sure they're not blameless on that, but like, yeah, I think they're a very well run organization willing to spend. And they've been successful. Like, I mean, this is a success the last decade or so has been largely kind of sustainable. So I had some blips and stuff, but some good overall stuff. Yeah, that is, I can't really quibble with that one. Do you have any honorable mentions? Obviously Miami, obviously San Antonio. Is there anyone that you think should have put on the list, or that you was kind of a cut for you? I only have one, I think.
Well, for me, like, I feel it's like a lazy take to say Milwaukee, but Milwaukee's obviously a good example too, where they lucked out certainly in the fact that Giannis blossomed into a superstar. And I was talking to Ty Windish, friend of the pod, about this the other day. Like, Chris, how lucky are we to say that we watched transcendental talent like LeBron James, and that Giannis Antetokounmpo has the potential to be that next transcendental talent? Like, we're spoiled as fans.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
And I was thinking about that, and then you kind of look at like how Milwaukee's constructed things. It's a very Budenholzer-esque team. I mean, can't wait for them to somehow get Al Horford this summer, and then they get Kyle Korver and Jeff Teague, and they just get the whole band back together, and it's the player of the month is just Milwaukee's like five-man bench rotation. But no, I really like the moves Milwaukee made. Like, getting Eric Bledsoe was a really smart move, and they were criticized for Brogdon at the time, but it's unlocked Chris Middleton for sure. And I think, yeah, no, acquiring Chris Middleton was an awesome move too, who was a second-round pick from Detroit. And just like a lot of smart moves, and like they have good ownership as well, who's committed to a small market, which is definitely refreshing. Milwaukee is one of those smaller teams as well. And no, it's just like, you know, small markets matter, and Milwaukee being such a arguably going to go down as one of the greatest teams of all time. Like, no, it's just, that's something, another good team to take a page out of if you want to be a team like that, especially if you're Cleveland. What about you, buddy? Is there a team that you'd give an honorable mention to?
Denver's one, because I look at them I think of like Mike Malone just being a guy that has improved the team every year, them kind of being smart and getting the right pieces, and I think doing a lot of really smart work. And, you know, obviously they hit on Jokic in a way I'm sure they didn't even expect, but like every team that we've mentioned and every team in the world gets lucky, you know, like the Warriors obviously got very lucky. I also would just say that Houston, you know, like that's just an organization that like the ownership stuff, there's a little bit, obviously a little bit different right now, but if you look at what Daryl Morey does, the way that they think about things in orthodoxy, I think that's a good thing to be done. That's a good thing to be done. Yeah, I think Portland. I think Portland too. I think just they've been pretty stable, and I think finding a star like Damian Lillard, who is just going to, I think a big thing for the Cavs, and maybe this is Oladipo in Indiana, but I think a big thing for the Cavs, and it could be Sexton, it could be the guy they draft, it could be KPJ, it could be Garland. I don't know who this guy is, But if you want to have, I think, kind of long-term success like that, a guy like Dame, who's going to shepherd the locker room, who's going to set the tone for everybody, who's going to be just like the ultimate true actual leader, you really, really want that. And I think identifying that and finding it and finding your Dame would be a really good thing for the Cavs. And I think like it would be a way for them that even if they don't maybe win a title, even if they end up being this team every year that's like the sixth seed or the fifth seed in the East or something like that, but they're competitive every year. That I know it's not the most fun thing to shoot for the middle ground, but if the Cavs could actually get there and show some kind of progress and do it that way, that would be a more productive outcome than the one we've seen, you know, when they've not had LeBron the last 20 years.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think that's just kind of something we've been stressing, like, for a while now. Like, Cleveland just necessarily hasn't found the quote-unquote guy yet. Maybe, like you said, it is Kevin Porter. Maybe it's Colin Sexton. Maybe it's Darius Garland. Hell, it could even be Dylan Windler. Surprise, surprise. But I don't really see him on this roster yet, and maybe they will come along in the draft. And I guess that's my question to you before we wrap things up. Do you think Cleveland is going to find the guy in free agency or the draft this summer, or are we going to keep having this conversation this time next year?
I would guess that we're still going to have some of this stuff next year. I think, you know, I can't speak to like what kind of leader he is, but I know Colin is definitely like a king. Could be. I think I could envision Colin Sexton being a real tone setter in a locker room. I think that's certainly on the table to some degree. But I, you know, I don't know. I would guess that the guy that could reshape the franchise is probably still not,
It's probably not yet
on the roster, and I would guess it's probably if and when it comes next, it's going to be via the draft. I think
his name is LeBron James Jr., and his father will help carry us the problem. So, I guess here's another fun question because I thought we were going to wrap this up. If Bronny Jr. wears zero, do you think the Cavs would give it to him, even though I feel like they'd retired for Kevin Love?
Yeah, it just depends on timing. I guess I don't know.
I'm just pulling your chain because that's the whole Colin Sexton getting two things still is in my craw after that talk. So
That's still interesting, and I get why they did it. There's a whole lot of stuff. I do hope one day that the Cavs and Kyrie make up. I don't know how likely it is, but I do hope that one day that they do ultimately kind of get on the same page. That would be cool.
That would be cool for sure, but. Yeah, no, I think I agree that the Cavs will be having this conversation probably to an extent this time next year as well. Maybe we have a better idea of, like, you and I touched on this a little bit, that Colin might become the kind of the heart and soul of this team going forward just based on his infectious attitude and just work ethic and just kind of takes over that Tristan Thompson role. But I don't know. The Cavs are kind of I don't even want to say they're at a crossroads yet because – they're still finding their way to the main road before they can even get to the crossroad. But when they do, hopefully they do take a page out of some of the teams we discussed and even some of the honorable mentions. And then teams like obviously Miami and San Antonio are just kind of like the best examples to take pages out of and kind of get out of their own way and just figure things out. So I'm interested to see what the future holds, and I'm trying to be more optimistic and just hoping for the best.
Yeah, so I will see what the Cavs do. We'll see kind of how they approach these next couple years. It is going to be interesting. Evan and I will be following along, just like we'll be following along with Wednesday's Cavs-Celtics game. So stay tuned for our coverage of that after we watch that game, see how it plays out in Cleveland Wednesday, 7 p.m. tip, and then they play Denver this weekend and San Antonio this weekend. So a tough slate for the Cavs. We'll cover it all here on Locked on Cavs. Thanks for listening.